and welcome to the very, very, very first podcast of True Stories from Tinseltown. And I am Grace. I will be your host of these True Stories from Tinseltown because I just love me some true stories of classic movies in Tinseltown. And there are many, 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 and I have some great guests coming up. But our guest today, our first guest, who is fabulous, and what a guy, Patrick C. Byrne, and he is the author of a book called Double Entendre, The Parallel Lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome, Patrick.
Hello, Grace.
Hello,
so glad to be talking to you.
I know, finally. You know, I ask this. It's so funny because, like, no, only a couple people do it with, you know, it's like, if you have a story, if you have something, let us know. And you want to come on the show, let us know. And you did. But how many months ago?
wasn't it like? Actually, it's a story in itself, isn't it?
It is. It could be a story. But we got it together and we're here. And I'm thrilled to have you.
And, Thank you.
This is going to be really interesting for a lot of people because I think, like myself, I did not know who Ray Bourbon was. And then when I Googled him, I was like, wowza. And Mae West, I love her. You know, I was doing her.
He's a legend among impersonators.
Yes. I'm reading this and it's really such an interesting story. So tell me, how did you get interested in doing this book about Ray and Mae?
Well, I had written a book previously about the opera diva Maria Callas, and I have always been an opera fan, even studied voice. And after I finished that, I thought, what else am I going to write about? And as you're always taught, write about what you know. Well, I thought, who else is interesting that I knew? And I knew Ray Bourbon at the twilight of his career when he was appearing at the Jewel Box in Kansas City. And I was just a student in beauty college at the time. And we used to go to the club where he appeared. Mm-hmm. And he used to mention Mae West a lot in his act. He modeled himself a lot on her. If you look at the way he looks, his makeup, his hair, and his double entendres, his innuendos.
Yes.
And I always loved Mae West. So I finally worked up enough nerve to meet him after he came off stage one night. And he told me he knew Mae West. He had worked with her. So that really piqued my interest. And it just sort of went from there. He told me so many interesting anecdotes, some of which I think maybe were a little exaggerated, but he was known for that anyway.
Yeah, there's so much. So he basically, tell us about his beginning. I read that he, you go on, you tell us about his beginning and how he became a performer.
And I think he embellished a bit about his beginning. You know, he took the name Bourbon and said that that was from the Royal Bourbons of France.
Les Bourbons.
But apparently his mother was a single woman who ended up in a convent pregnant in France. And, of course, the nuns weren't going to allow that. And she was befriended by a wealthy nun there who managed to get her to the United States to some of her distant relatives in Hoodsmith County, Texas, of all places, on the border. And they were going to take the lady in and let her have the baby there and then keep her as a housekeeper. And unfortunately, she died during the birth of her
Ray. Oh, how sad.
Yes, very sad. But the people were very nice. Their name was Waddell. And they adopted Ray, so he would have a name, and he became Ray Waddell. But it wasn't destined to be for very long because Ray was gay and knew it from the time he was a child. And it was on a ranch in southern Texas. You can imagine how that worked out.
Yeah, especially in those days. I mean, it's bad enough now, but
exactly.
Then, and ouch.
His father, who had adopted him, died, and the mother remarried, and the man she remarried didn't like Ray because he was obviously effeminate. And one thing led to another. He got caught having an affair with one of the ranch hands, and there was a murder. It's kind of cloudy. We'll never know exactly what happened. But the father had a friend in London that had a school for troubled young men. Mm-hmm. And so they shipped him off to London, which was the best thing they could have ever done for him. He was just in his early teens. And there was a teacher who took a fancy to him. He was one of the dramatic teachers there, taught theater. And he introduced Ray to the world of the music hall, which is a great deal like the predecessor to American vaudeville. And it was at that time Ray saw for the first time a female impersonator, which is a very accepted art form in British theater. And Ray was immediately taken with it. And one thing led to another, and he got a job in the chorus and eventually worked up to do a few solo spots. And that was really his beginning as an impersonator.
Oh, so he always did that.
He always wanted to.
That's interesting. I read something that there was scotch and bourbon. Was he a part of a team?
Yes, and sherry and bourbon. He worked, you know, especially when he came to America, it was very hard to break into vaudeville because there were thousands of vaudeville entertainers. And believe it or not, female impersonators were an integral part of any vaudeville house.
That seems so weird then.
It does, and the people didn't look on them as gay. They thought they were clever, and some of them were quite beautiful, wore beautiful clothes, and the women, of course, were fascinated with the fashion. Ray was never beautiful, but he was always clever. He was kind of a stand-up comedian and very raunchy. So he had trouble, even back then, getting work in some of the more family-oriented vaudeville houses, because vaudeville was what people went to. You didn't have movies at the beginning.
No, it was like, whatever happened to Baby Jane, right? The vaudeville theaters, there she was.
Yes, exactly.
And Ray was appearing right after Baby Jane. How perfect.
Yes. It's interesting in that... he got into movies also, silent movies, because, you know, the movie industry was in New York, in Brooklyn, in Long mm-hmm. Island. He went to work at a movie company called Vitagraph, who really began the movies. They were silent films, of course, mm-hmm. and he was an extra. And they found out he was a female impersonator, and they loved it because he could do the stunt work for the leading ladies in the movie, so they didn't want to have him falling off horses and downstairs.
Yeah.
So that's really how he got started doing that. And it was during that time, which I thought was very interesting, he met a man called Guglielmi, I can't pronounce it. And it turned out to be, later on, Rudolph Valentino. But this was before Rudolph got into the films. He was a gigolo and a taxi dancer.
Wow, a taxi dancer, too?
Yes.
A gigolo for male or female?
Not female.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, to begin with. We don't know what happened later on.
Yes.
That's always been a question.
Yeah.
His sexuality. And he was married to two lesbians, which I thought was very strange.
You never know. You just never know. But he met him and befriended. He befriended him?
He did. He liked Ray for some reason. And Rudy got involved in a shooting with some lady's husband who caught them. And he had to flee New York, and he ended up in Hollywood. But he remembered Ray. And years later, Ray ended up in Hollywood as a movie extra, and he got Ray work in some of his movies. He was in Blood and Sand with Rudolph. You can see him in some of the first frames. He plays a matador, all things.
A macho, yeah.
Yeah, macho, yeah. A drag queen matador. And there's a scene where he's gored and he dies, and Rudolph rushes to his aid and he cradles him in his arms, and Ray Bourbon dies in his arms, and he says, "Can you imagine? I'm the only queen that ever died in Rudolph Valentino's honor."
That's pretty cool.
It is cool. And he made a movie with a woman called Nazimova, who was a friend of Rudolph Valentino's wife. And it was rumored they were lovers, which I think they were. Mm-hmm. And it was a film of Salome, of all things. The Seven Veils.
Oh, of course. Norma Desmond was going to play her.
Yeah.
She was writing her 5,000-page script.
Is that perfect?
Yeah.
Exotica really did reign back then in Hollywood. They loved anything exotic. And Nazimova insisted on hiring an all-day cast for the film. And it's a silent film, too. And you can see Ray in several of the scenes sitting at the table of the court with Herodias and the king and Anazimova doing her hoochie coochie seven veil dance. Really, it's strange, isn't it? He supplemented his income quite a bit with being an extra. He got a contract with Paramount. A friend of his, when he was living in Greenwich Village in New York, when he was still doing silent movies there, thought he was very pretty. And the guy was a photographer, professional photographer. And he took some of Ray's photos in drag and, without telling Ray, submitted them to a movie magazine that was having a contest. And the winner of it would get a contract with Paramount. Well, of all things, Ray won. And then he had to go to Los Angeles, and they were expecting a woman.
I didn't think he looked so hot. I didn't think he was the prettiest woman in drag. Yikes!
Well, when he was young, he was pretty. He was pretty. He got very strange looking as he got older. Most drag queens do. They turn from, if they started out as beauties, they'll turn to comedy if they get fat and old, because you kind of have to.
You can't go around going, hey, baby.
But anyway, he showed up at Paramount, and they were horrified. They didn't know what to do with him, and they'd already published his name and everything in the magazine. So they hired him as an extra for several of their leading ladies at the time. There was one in particular, Estelle Taylor, and Ray really did look like her at the time. So they used him as her stunt double for falling off horses and falling down staircases. Mm-hmm. And they became good friends too. They had a lifelong friendship. He was just a myriad of things. He was on radio. He had his own club in Hollywood for a while. He appeared in vaudeville as a female impersonator. He did anything he could to pay the rent.
But didn't he? I'm sorry, Patrick. I read something that he inherited $1.5 million. Is that true, or is that a myth?
Well, he did inherit quite a bit of money from his mother in his adoptive mother, mother in Texas. It wasn't that much, but it was a lot of money. And he went through it because he was very foolish.
Yeah, I read he got a lot of minks and just stupid things.
And gowns, and he traveled to Europe. You know, he went to Ray went to England and went back and looked up some of his old friends from the music hall. And at one point, he even gave a command performance for King Edward and Wallis Simpson, who was his mistress at the time, at Port Belvedere in London.
As a drag queen or as a guy?
As a drag queen. And he did a number with, there was a movie trio, kind of like the Three Stooges, but they were British and they were called the Crazy Gang. And he does this sort of insane number at this soiree, which unfortunately they sang an anti-Nazi song. And the king and Mrs. Simpson, as you knew, were Nazi sympathizers. And
yes.
They were very offended.
As they denied, but they were. Yeah.
Sure.
Just upstanding
citizens.
And from
there, he went to Paris, and he worked with Josephine Baker, the famous black star.
Yes, of course. She was fabulous.
And he was just in the chorus there. But she hired lots of gay people. She was very, very gay friendly.
Well, there were so many in the entertainment field. It's like, how could you, I don't know. How could you be homophobic? Because there was, so many gay guys and lesbians. And of course, let's face it, with the rumors, everybody was pretty much gay or lesbian, everybody. So,
Gary Cooper and Cary Grant and Randall Scott, which that really was pretty much true.
Really? What did I never heard the Gary Cooper scoop. What is that?
Well, he was kind of a switch hitter from what I found in my research. He started out not as a gigolo exactly, but there was an awful lot of casting couch going on. Mm-hmm. There was a very famous countess from Italy named Countess di Prazzo. She was an old biddy, she's an ugly old rich lady. And she kept him for a while, and I believe she lived in Rome, and then he came back to Hollywood. She chased him clear to Hollywood.
Well, that's funny. I never, ever, ever heard about Gary Cooper. being anything
more of
but
a rumor.
Yeah,
I don't think it's ever been verified. There's no photographs of anything, but
yeah,
it was rumored.
I wouldn't be shocked. I wouldn't be shocked about anybody. Let's face it.
And you know, the magazines back then would subtly try to out people. Giving you into a suggestion that they might be gay.
Well, look at Carrie and Randolph Scott.
Randolph.
I mean, my goodness, they're like frolicking, cooking in the kitchen, wearing aprons. They're
living
the two bachelors.
Long.
Yeah.
They were already big stars. And
yeah.
Living together. So,
I know. So that was like, well, it was subtle. You're right. It wasn't like, we'll discuss later on. When did May get into it? She was very much... I think I saw her first film. It was Night After Night or something. George Raft was in it.
It was George Raft, and she had she got fourth billing probably. May was 40 when she got into film.
Yes.
She'd been in vaudeville forever.
And they called her fat, too. I read the thing. But she was a riot. Oh, my God. In that movie, she was hysterical.
Well, you know, the movie, basically, she saved Paramount from bankruptcy. That was during the Depression era, and people went nuts for her the first time they saw her in that film. As George Raft said, she stole everything but the cameras.
She did. That was like one of her first lines when the lady said, "Oh my goodness, your jewels! Goodness, had nothing to do with it, honey." You know,
and sauntered up the steps in that skin tight silver lined dress.
I loved her, and she was such a riot with that actress. Who had the crush on, who was teaching George Raft how to be a gentleman.
Oh, it was a wonderful scene.
And they're in bed together. And at first she thinks May's asking her to become one of her girls because she thinks May's a hooker. And May is has hair salons.
She's a hairdresser. She said, "Well, what's the name of your salon?" And she said, "It's the Institute de Butte."
So that was hysterical.
In that Brooklyn accent. She had a terrible accent.
But it was a riot.
Oh, it's perfect for her.
I mean, she was just such a character. So she met Ray in the 30s. They ran into each other there.
Actually, she met Ray in about 1927. She had written a play called The Drag. First, she had written a play called Sex, which you didn't even say that word out loud.
I know.
My God, the thing got rated. Of course, she loved all that. It was free publicity. People lined up to buy tickets.
Well, didn't it get rated? Like, how did she ever even get any performances out of it because it got rated
it
so much?
It actually ran for almost a year.
Wow.
But it did get rated once, and they put her in jail for 10 days, but she got out. And there's lots of pictures of her. In jail.
I have to look those up. I've never seen any pictures of her in the slammer. That must have been a riot.
Oh, they're funny. She was quite plump then. She wasn't as good looking as she was when she got to Hollywood. They made her over.
Yeah.
But the play that she wrote called The Drag was exactly that. It was about a bunch of homosexuals, and the last half of the play is a drag party with all these female impersonators. And she went to Greenwich Village to the gay clubs to interview these, because there were lots of gay clubs there. And she met Ray, and he was one of something like 50 or 60 drags that were in that show. And I think it played one or two performances, and they tried to come to New York, and the vice squad said, "Uh-uh, you're not coming to New York. This is a town." And they got raided, too, in Hollywood. That was his introduction to May, and they sort of became friends after that. They stayed in touch. And May was very influenced by female impersonators. I mean, look at how exaggerated.
Oh my God! Over the top, the wiggle, the whole thing, and she was just too cool for words, though. I mean, she really was.
Especially for the time.
Yeah.
Yet she never used dirty language. She never exposed anything. Her dresses were long.
Mm-hmm.
She obviously had a big bust, but she didn't wear real low cut dresses. She had long sleeves. But everything she said had a double meaning.
Her double entendres, which were a riot. Yes, I love.
There's an interesting story. When she was on the radio, she was already a Paramount star by then, but stars would go on the radio because radio was, you know, a big entertainment back in the 30s. And she was on the Chasin Sanborn Hour with Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen, who was a ventriloquist.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a skit and it was a skit of Adam and Eve. Well, now that sounds perfectly harmless, but when they got done with it, the talking to the snake and getting the big apple, she said, get me a big apple. I feel like doing a big apple. And they had made her read the script before they let her do it in an audition to make sure that, you know, everything was okay. And she read it straight. It sounded fine. It sounded biblical. But when she read it on the radio, they said the switchboard lit up. People were calling in and complaining that this lewd woman was making fun of the Bible. And it got her priceless publicity.
Did May ever get married?
She did to a man named Frank Wallace in about 1911 or 1917. She was a very young girl traveling with her mother on the vaudeville circuit, and she met this song and dance man, and she was taken with him. Of course, May got taken with men very easily, and he talked her into getting married, and they had their own act together, and she didn't like him after she married him, and she went back home to her mother. And they never got a divorce. And, of course, May later became a huge star. And then he decides to go after her after she was living in California because, as you know, it's a 50-50 split.
Community property state.
That's right. And he tried to get money out of her. And he did get some, but it was never revealed how much. There's also the story that she was married to an accordion player called Guido D'Aro.
Guido and May. Sounds perfect.
Guido
a love
May.
Story.
Well,
yeah.
You should have seen him. He was really a hunk.
We're really?
Wow. Oh, very good looking man.
Was he straight? May always seemed to be hanging with the gay guys. That's
he was straight.
Yeah.
He was straight. And there was even a couple of things in Variety about Mr. and Mrs. D'Aro appearing on stage together. So I would think it would be odd that Variety would say that if they weren't married. And apparently years later, somebody found a divorce license with those two names, Maybelle West and Guido D'Aro. Now, that's quite a coincidence.
Yeah. Who knew? I never heard of him.
Yeah. She refers to him in her book, Goodness Had Nothing to Do With It. You know, she wrote a biography. Very carefully pruned, as most Hollywood stars do when they write their own stuff.
Yeah.
It was all good. It was all wonderful. But she refers to him and said that he was kind of the love of her life. So I think it lends a little credence to the fact that they may have been hitched at
one
time. Yeah,
it does. Now, I read that Ray said he had been married twice.
Yes, but, you know, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of proof along that line. I could not find anything definite about that. It supposedly he even had a son.
Oh, I read that too, yes.
But Ray really tended to exaggerate and then contradict himself. So I sort of did pick and choose as I went through this stuff. I wanted a fairly cohesive storyline, lifeline, and something that you could follow. If I'd added in all the reams and reams of stuff that I had found on him, the book would have been 800 pages instead of 400.
Yeah, because you have, and also you have May in there as well, so.
Oh, of course, yeah. May, because, you know, it had to be parallel. I tried to keep it easy. There are some spaces in between where, well, there's even some spaces in May's career that are questionable. She kind of dropped out of vaudeville when she was quite young because she couldn't really make it. She wanted to be a star, and she wasn't. And there's a pretty firm, I did a lot of research on vaudevillians, who many of whom said that May worked the Columbia circuit that was called the Columbia Wheel, which was burlesque. But, of course, she denied she was ever in burlesque. But all you have to do is look at her move.
She was a rock.
I mean, you don't learn that at a tap dancing school.
I would think not, no. Or as a brownie or a Cubs, or a Girl Scout, if they had them then. Who knows?
But, exactly.
So, Ray, did he ever have, like, a long-term significant other?
Never. He never did. He moved around too much. Female impersonators, you know, don't usually get booked in for like 6 month runs. They might do a weekend here and 2 weeks there. I think it made it almost impossible for him to really form a significant bond with anybody else. And I think he would have been very difficult. And when I knew him, and he was an old man by then, he was almost 70, he was pretty snippy, pretty bitchy.
Really?
Yes, he really was.
Do you think it was because he was older, or that was his M.O. kind of deal?
No, when you listen to the recordings he made, and by the way, he made about 12 LPs during the LP era.
That's amazing. I didn't.
It is.
Yeah, that's a lot. Most comics at that time maybe made two, three, four.
It was a record label called UTC, which means under the counter, because initially you had to ask for them, and they would reach under the counter to get them. They would put them out, you know, on the shelves. But that was in the early 50s when there was a lot of censorship. And, you know, looking at the pictures and reading the names of the songs, some of them were a little on the blue side, as they said.
Well,
but he made records in the 30s, too. He made 78 records, singles, you know, like people used to collect, the shellac things.
Yeah, and who did he play when he was a female impersonator? Did he play specific people, or is he just some chick?
No, he basically played the Ray Bourbon character. When you met him off the stage or you watched him on stage, he was still very much, he was like Mae West. You know, she created a persona.
Yes.
Ray did too. I'm sure when he was young, he was different, but that was, you know, that was the turn of the last century. So he had kind of gelled into this sort of iconic, bitchy, clever, very cutting, campy, what we so often think of when we think of a drag queen.
Yeah, and also, he got raided a lot. He got thrown in the pokey quite a few times just for doing his shows, impersonating a woman. Can you imagine? Jeez.
Pardon? I think we had a little drop out there.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can't now, but
okay.
I think it was like 30 seconds.
Oh, dear me.
No, that's no problem.
No, 30 seconds isn't bad. If it was longer, it would be horrible. But,
yeah,
he got arrested quite a bit.
A great deal. Because female impersonation in many places was against the law. Especially if you came off stage and went outside in your garb, you know, your lashes and your
whatever. Yeah.
And he would do that. He would, you know, and they would arrest him and he'd go to jail, pay the fine, and then go right back to the club the next night and work. May, of course, got arrested too several times.
I know.
I think makes them kind of parallel. They were kindred spirits when it came to that.
Yeah, and she was very accepting of everybody. May was pretty cool. I like that about her, that she, you know, she just liked who you were, you know.
She, as long as you were appreciative of her too, because she really did like to be almost worshipped.
Wow, she was.
Yeah,
she was.
Yeah.
She did.
She had a huge following.
And all the guys, all the muscle men, she always had with her whenever she went anywhere.
Well, you know, she did that in 1954 in Las Vegas when her movie career had basically been over since 1944. And she made a comeback, and she said, you know, why can't women ogle, I think she called them slabs of beefcake, just like men like to go to these girly clubs and see the girls dancing around in their feathers. So she got a bunch of muscle men, you know, Mr. Universe and those kind of guys.
Mickey Haggerty?
Mickey Haggerty, yeah. Jane Mansfield's husband,
mm-hmm.
And she put them in little loincloths.
Very Tarzan.
And they would carry her out on a chaise lounge.
Oh, brother.
With one of her big feathered headdresses, and she would have her black maid, Beulah, with her, and she'd sit there, and they'd, you know, they'd sing to her and dance, and then turn their backs to the audience, and they'd have on these capes, and then open the capes, and of course, she's gawking at their manhood. She did that for years. She toured that all over the country.
But even when she was 80, I think how I saw Mae West or knew about Mae West was probably through some afternoon television show. But, I mean, she kind of scared me as a kid because she was like 80, you know what I mean? And she had the hair and the facelifts and the makeup. And she did kind of scare me a little bit.
Well, I can understand that. You know, when she made her last film, A Sextet, when she was in her 80s by then, it's kind of gruesome. And, you know, Rex Reed, the famous gay critic, hated her because he had been in the movie Myra Breckinridge.
What a horrible movie.
But, you know, it's got a cult following.
Yes. I love how blue-eyed Rex Reed becomes brown-eyed Raquel Welch.
Absolutely.
How did that happen?
It's an amazing movie. And anyway, May didn't like him on the set. He knew it. So when she made her next movie, Sextet, he said she looked like something they found in the basement of a pyramid.
Oh, my. Rex. But he was funny.
Yeah. Well, he was bitchy queen.
Very funny, though. Very
clever. Her last two movies are kind of unfortunate because if that's what young people think Mae West was, it isn't.
Yes. Well, I found out later.
It was better than Sextet. Sextet's almost unviewable. They had to put her on wheels, literally. They built a little platform
with wheels
because she couldn't walk, and they just kind of pulled her around.
Didn't she write it or something? That was like her whole thing.
She wrote it in 1961. It's from a play that she toured in that was not successful. And two queens that adored her thought that it would make a wonderful movie, so they financed it because no legitimate production company would have touched it. But if you like something really bad, so bad that it's good, it's worth watching. I've got a copy of it.
I don't think it's ever been. I've never seen it on TV, but I have.
No.
Yeah.
No.
I'll have to check that out. I'm sure I can find it.
You'd die laughing because Tony Curtis is in it. And Timothy Dalton.
And they're all telling her how gorgeous she is, and she's like 85, ready to die.
They're her six ex-husbands.
Oh, brother.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, May.
but, you know, she believed in herself.
Yeah.
So.
I heard she was really short. That's why she would wear like 6-inch platform shoes, and she always had to wear those. That's why she always wore those really long dresses all the time.
Actually, those shoes were called cruel shoes. They were platforms, and then they built things inside of them that took them up another 3 or 4 inches.
Yikes.
And they were excruciating to walk in, and that's why she walked the way she did.
I bet.
You know, she undulated. She went as much sideways as she did forward.
She did. I'm so glad I'm 5'8 and never had to wear those kind of shoes. Thank you, God. But so let's get back to Ray now. Now, May was fabulous.
Sure.
Ray, in the 50s, there was Christine Jorgensen, who was the first sex change operation, went from male to female. And then Ray decides to tell everybody. But he didn't, did he?
Well, he even when I knew him, he would tell one story and then another. He wanted to keep you guessing because he did it because his career was in the toilet.
Yes.
And he got the publicity. He managed to get in the newspapers, and people wanted to come and see somebody that had a sex change. And of course, he wasn't going to show them his altered sex organs.
Right.
Because you couldn't do that. But the funny thing was, he got arrested in a club in San Francisco because they hired him as a stand-up comedian in a tuxedo. He was good at doing that. And the police were alerted and said, well, there's a woman dressed as a man. And, of course, he wasn't. He was a man. But they hauled him off to jail. And it was kind of ironic. Here he is dressed as a man in a tuxedo, and he told everyone he was a woman.
Isn't that funny? I can't believe they even. But you don't know. Nobody knows. Nobody knows if he actually did it.
He had it done in Juarez, in Mexico.
Oh, so you do think he did it?
Well, he went there for an operation, but from what I can garner, it was a cancer surgery.
Yeah.
It was cancer surgery, and he tried to cover it up and decided to use it. He even had a certificate signed by this doctor that said he changed his genitals. He was now a woman.
R-A-Y now? Ray Berman?
R-A-Y. But, you know, that's an interesting thing. May, I have to make a little bit with my publisher because I knew him as Ray, R-A-E, and he wanted me to use R-A-Y, and most people today knew him as R-A-E. My editor wrote a wonderful preface in the book called What's in a Name? He said, said the spelling of Raven's first name is a conundrum wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, to paraphrase a quotation of Winston Churchill. But perhaps there is a key. He vacillated between Ray, R-A-Y, and R-I-E for the better part of his adult life. And they interviewed him about it, and he said they are both simply names. R-A-Y is my given name, and the one I used for many years. R-I-E is really my stage name.
Yeah, so, but, you know, Ray is a guy's name, so what difference did it make if he became a woman and became R-A-Y to me?
Well, that was
it would be more R-A-E.
That's kind of typical of him, though. I think he, whichever way the wind blew, he went with it. He was very much of an opportunist. But I've known lots of female impersonators. It's a very tough profession, even today, and you kind of have to go with what's going on.
What do you mean, update and just go with
update, and you get an offer for a sleazy club, and you go there, and you get, you know, Ray played some wonderful venues, and he played some absolute rat holes. He toured with the Jewel Box, not the Kansas City Jewel Box, but the famous group, and it was called the Jewel Box. They toured all over the United States, and it was huge. They had production numbers like Broadway shows. They had people who sang opera. They had ballerinas. You know, they had an orchestra. It was very lovely, and that sort of thing doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, and I don't think, are there that many drag clubs anymore?
Well, for instance, I'm in Kansas City, and we have two very nice gay clubs, one of which is called Hammer Mary's, and they do a drag show every night, but they do it as fundraisers for needy people and groups and animal protection groups.
Oh, that's
and all
nice.
Sorts of,
yeah.
Very nice. And they do a nice show. And then we have one called Missy B's, which is more traditional. And they put on a little more complex drag show. They have comedians and dancers and singers and lip syncers and that sort of thing. And I find that when I travel, there are still quite a few drag venues. Very often it'll be a gay club all week, and maybe they'll have one or two special nights where they do female impersonation.
Yeah, a friend of mine, I guess he worked for Jim Bailey a few times when Jim Bailey went on the
fabulous
road.
Fabulous impersonator.
Yes, to London, and he was his orchestra leader, and he said Jim was a great guy, and he was going to work with him again. Jim was like, he still worked into, I think he was, how old was he when he died, like 80-something?
Yes, he worked. I've got lots of video bits of him. He could do almost any character. That's the one thing I kind of decry today with impersonation. So much of it is just lip syncing.
Yeah, that stinks. It's not like it used to be.
And they're not even very good at it. I remember the ones at the Jewel Box that would lip sync, but they had it down to an art. I mean, they copied the movement of the artist who was singing. They had the look. They did the makeup of the hair like that. And now it's just whatever the pop music is, the disco music, and they get up and jump around and go around. And I find it demeaning that they take money from the audience while they're performing. I just think that's strange. I don't think there's anything wrong with tipping somebody, but I think you should do it after the performance is over.
Oh, that's tacky. Yeah.
I think so also.
Very tacky.
We're probably going to get lots of negative on this.
Well, you know, maybe it's not, you know, to some people, obviously it's not tacky, you know, it's heads or tails. Whatever anyone wants to do, they can do, but it just seems, it's like the wedding dance. You ever see this dance? I haven't seen it in years, but when I was a little kid, people would dance with a bride and they'd like stuff money on her dress and stuff. That's tacky, if you ask me.
I had an uncle from Palermo, Sicily, and I used to go to lots of the weddings, and there was a lot of that. You know, you get enough money to have a down payment on a home.
I know. Well, Italian weddings. I mean, my God. Those I've seen, that they really go all out. And
I love it.
Yes, and tons of great food. I'm just generalizing, but I say the ones that I've been to have been yummy. You know, fun and yummy.
I'm going to read you something.
Okay.
It's really my intro to Ray. When I first saw him, the first night I saw him, I was still in beauty school. We'd all taken the bus from school down to the Jewel Box, and we went during the week because there was no cover charge and we didn't have any money. All right. And it says, just prior to the star of the show was a remarkable operatic voice, Cary Davis, who sang in a shimmering falsetto soprano. The applause for Cary was interrupted with a loud drum roll and a sweeping piano arpeggio accompanying the voice of the mistress of ceremonies. Ladies and gentlemen, the Jewel Box proudly announces the world-renowned Mr. Ray Bourbon. From the wings swayed a tall, buxom, and somewhat elderly vision in a long silver gown, dragging a rather moth-eaten white box stole in one hand and a bar stool in the other. Clamped in what were obviously ill-fitting and impossibly white false teeth was a long rhinestone cigarette holder. Large, droopy earlobes were adorned with the longest chandelier earrings I had ever seen. Framing a pleasant but well-worn face was a carefully waved and curled silver wig that matched the color of the gown. I suddenly realized that the hair was a dead ringer for the style that Mae West favored in so many of her films, a retro do from the 1930s. The makeup resembles something from a bygone era, a gash of Chinese red lipstick fully outlining pendulous lips, carefully drawn eyebrows that bore no resemblance to anything human, and eyelashes were so long that touched the upper reaches of the penciled brow. All of this maquillage spoke of a vision of feminine glamour that was now only a faded memory. Nothing prepared me for his voice. A startling baritone at the bottom, a nasal buzz in the middle, and a flapping soprano at the top. All of this was punctuated with a laugh best described as a chicken's cackle.
Who wrote that? That guy doesn't miss a trick. You know, God forbid you. He would be the one to go to if you had spinach in your teeth. Who the heck wrote that? That was amazing.
I wrote it.
You wrote it?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my God. What a great right. I mean, you really, yeah, you would definitely tell me if I had spinach in my teeth, right?
I certainly would. Well, you know, I'm in the beauty industry. I'm a makeup artist, so.
What a great write-up.
Well, thank you.
Do you have some of Ray's voice for us so we can hear?
I do. Let me see.
I have never heard this man.
Let me see where Ray is. Oh. I think I've got a tape. Hang on a second.
Okay.
I still have a tape deck, believe it or not.
Well, you should.
Yeah.
Put it on eBay. You could sell it for $1,000. Really? They're making like vinyls again.
I'm looking for a new turntable.
They have them.
Here we go.
I can't hear them. Patrick? Can't hear Ray. Patrick? Hello? I can't hear him. Hello, my name is Ray Bourbon.
There's the famous cackle.
We couldn't hear it. I couldn't hear a thing. I heard like a little bit of a...
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Sorry. You know, I think I'll be able to get it. Maybe I can, you know, I put like little things before the podcast so I can put maybe I'll find... Do you think I can find something on YouTube of him?
Yes, there are sound recordings, nothing visual, unfortunately, was never captured on tape, which is very sad.
It is sad. And yes. They had tape. They said they have so much great stuff on YouTube. One of the things I was reading, do you know who C. Dan is? He's this gossip guy who says he's an entertainment lawyer.
I've heard the name.
Yeah, well, he does some old Hollywood stuff, and this was years ago when he first started, and he just went on and on saying the stagehand, and it went into this big convoluted story about Alice Brady and her being sick, and then a male took over her role and played her whole part, and then he said it was Ray Bourbon, who never heard of it. It was like this big letdown because it was this
really?
Big convoluted story. I believe it was Ray Bourbon, and it looked like his picture. And I'm like, and I wrote him. I said, "Are you kidding? That is like, you know, you have this months of build up of all this like tomfoolery.
Now, that's what I've never heard. How interesting. I'd like to pursue that.
Well, I looked it up for you. You know, I think he got so much grief for that, you know, because he kept doing it and kept adding it on, saying, I'm going to reveal this at this certain date. And he got a lot of crap when he revealed it. So I don't think it's there, because I looked it up and I went to his site and put in Ray Bourbon and Alice Brady and I found nothing. So I think that went gone with the wind, but I'll never forget it because I was like outraged because he's teasing everybody. And I was like, what is he talking about? And I watched that movie like he took over for her and Godfrey. What is it? My Man Godfrey.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find it. Google it, but
I'd love to know that. I will Google it.
But I don't believe it's true. I mean, I take what he says with
either.
That's why he was really like, people were disgusted with him, and I'm sure he took it out. But, you know, he has a lot of long, long blind items. They're interesting. You should check it out. It's C. Dan, entertainment lawyer. But, you know, you have to take what he says with a grain of salt. You just don't know. That's for sure. So let's get to Ray's, let's go into his later years when he was really just poor and riding around in trailers and what happened to poor Ray.
Very sad. That's kind of when I knew him. The jewel box was his last engagement.
He was 70?
He was. He was there frequently. He'd be there for a month or two and then he'd go off to Chicago for a weekend and unfortunately, he was a hoarder. He was an animal hoarder. He loved dogs, and he would collect stray dogs, and he kept them kind of all penned up in this old house, the yard of an old house he lived in. And when he traveled, he couldn't get anybody who was willing to come and take care of that many dogs. So he had an old station wagon, and he had a trailer, a wooden trailer enclosed, attached to the back of the wagon, and he'd put all these dogs in the wagon and take them on his trips.
Yikes.
And unfortunately, going to a club in Texas, the station wagon overheated and broke down, and he was in a small town, and he didn't know what he was going to do. He had to get on to the engagement that he was booked for. He needed the money, and he couldn't take the dogs. So he found a veterinarian who said he would be willing to board them until Ray came back and paid him. Well, Ray was not the most reliable person in the world, and he came back to Kansas City to fulfill an engagement, skipped going through the town in Texas, and it took him weeks and weeks and weeks to get a hold of the man and get some money to him. And by that time, the veterinarian had disposed of all the dogs. And he didn't know if he killed them or sold them or what he'd done to them. And he was very upset about it. And he had a boyfriend at the time, a hustler, literally a street hustler that he was paying for an apartment for, lived across the hall from him. And the hustler saw an opportunity to get some money. He thought if he went down to Texas and threatened this vet and to find out where the dogs were, Ray would probably reward him with a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, he found Ray's gun and took it with him, and he and another hustler went to Texas, confronted the man, things went wrong, the gun went off, and they killed the vet. And they got arrested. And, of course, they spilled the beans and said that this drag queen had paid them to come down and kill the vet. And so Ray was working back at the jewel box in Kansas City, and one night the police come in, and he's arrested and extradited and sent to Texas to stand trial, where he was convicted because it was a very small town, redneck.
Yeah, I read he wrote to people and saying that Midnight Cowboy was banned there and things like that. He got 99 years, didn't he?
He did what?
He got 99 years in jail.
Yes, he did. And he died from medical neglect. He was diabetic. He had heart trouble by then.
How horrible.
And they just let him die because he was
cruel.
An old queen.
Yeah.
It's very cruel.
But they still do that today in these places.
Oh, sure.
But
in the wrong jail. It probably wouldn't have happened in Kansas City if he'd been jailed here.
Good. I'm glad there's good jail somewhere. But I want to ask you, so you're saying, because I've read other things that say, that Ray did say that he wanted to know the truth about what happened to his dogs, and he sent them down there, but he did not send them down there to kill them. But you're saying that they took it on their own.
The boy's last name was Cisco.
Yeah.
And he is the one who apparently did pull the trigger. He had a cohort with him, and Ray did not send them down there for that purpose.
Did he? Who got 10 years? The trigger guy or his boyfriend?
I think the trigger guy got 10 years. I think the other one got off, frankly.
Wow. And Ray got 99 years. And you know what the saddest thing to me, Patrick, is what I read is that he actually escaped and he came back in 2 hours because he didn't have anywhere to go.
It was freezing cold, and the jail was kind of an odd setup. And he was allowed to kind of go in his cell and come out and use the phone downstairs. And he was making calls to people that he knew that were famous from the past to try to get them to get him a lawyer, get him out of there. And the back door had been left open, and it was windy, and it was banging. And he stepped outside, and the door banged shut behind him. And they found him in the floorboard of a truck outside the jail. It was freezing, because he, you know, tried to get out of the elements, and he never really recovered from that. His health went downhill after that. It was basically an accident. It was very unfortunate.
How old was he when he died?
Oh, 70 or 71. Again, the birth dates are kind of funny. May lied about her age, and so did Gray. They supposedly were a year apart.
And May was born on my birthday, August 17th.
But there you go.
Yes.
1893 in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
That was on May.
Ray was born in 1892 in Hudspeth County, Sierra Block, Texas, which is just a dot on the map.
So did anyone bury Ray? Did he have not? Yeah. I hope he didn't go to Potter's Field or something like that.
He didn't. One of the gentlemen who was his piano accompanist in his heyday when they were on the big vaudeville circuit became a famous composer, pianist in Hollywood years later. He heard about Ray's demise, and he managed to have him properly buried.
That's really, I'm glad to hear that. Because
such
a, you know, he lived 10 lives and a half. You know, if you guys read this book, and you're going to be just so fascinated by him and what he did and his, you know, his arrests and his pictures, why'd you see the pictures? And of course, we love May. What were her final days like?
May was a little, as they say, addlepated at the end. She was diabetic, and she loved to eat sweets. One of the muscle men from her muscle men show, Paul Novak, loved her. He really did love her. And he
loved her as a mommy or was in love with her or just loved her as a person?
I think he loved her as a woman.
Wow.
He loved her as a woman. And he was younger than her, very handsome. But, you know, he loved the Mae West image. He took care of her. He lived with her. He fed her. He took her to the doctor. He drove her around. When she would make public appearances, he was always hovering in the background, you know, because you never knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
She lived in a fantasy at the end because she was really kind of out of it. She still, you know, her apartment was still all white fur and gold ormolu.
Where was that? In Hollywood? Beverly Hills?
The Raven. It's the original apartment that she bought when she first came to Hollywood to make A Night After Night with George Rapp.
Wow.
She bought the whole apartment building. It was called the Ravenswood.
Wow.
And she lived a little kind of Sunset Boulevard, Norma Desmond.
Yeah, that's what it seemed like, that she really, you know, to see, like I said, she scared me as a kid. And here she is, this old lady coming out with this funky hair and the eyelashes.
Incredibly self-centered, and she admitted it, which I think was admirable.
Yeah, so at least she knew. Yeah,
She said, I invented a character. Nobody could play Mae West other than me, and she said, I had to write all my own material for movies. She never liked what screenwriters wrote for her. She'd always change it.
Which one's the one with W.C. Fields? My Little Chickadee?
My Little Chickadee, which is unfortunately, that's what the public remembers her the most for, and it really is not her best film.
But it cracked me up, though. Because, you know, her on the train, and she's taking the guns, and she's taking everybody out, going behind her back. And there's a scene with her and N.W.C. Fields, and you can see she's truly cracking up for real. It's not just like a laugh. So I like that.
She had problems with him because he drank, and she, believe it or not, she did not approve of anyone drinking or smoking.
Never, ever, ever?
No, she never drank or smoked.
May.
No. Well, she believed in high colonics and eating healthy and exercise.
But she did love her bonbons.
She loved her bonbons. She loved her sweets. And we used to say the blue-haired bonbon eaters.
It's too funny. I'm going to give you my line from Mae West. I made up when I was 6 years old. Tell me if I made it up or not. I used to do it really good. And it's called 1 + 1 = 2. I got two men coming over here in 1 hour, so you better skidoo. Didn't I make that up myself? She didn't do that, right? She never said that.
No, she didn't do that, but that's exactly, it's right on the money.
Isn't it? I made that up at 6. I was doing it. My cousin would prod me, and I would do the hand on the hip, and the, But she still scared the crap out of me. I don't know.
I think she would be frightening to a child.
Yes.
I first saw her on black and white TV, because I'm 75.
And, you sound like such a youth, a whippersnapper.
Well, thank you. I can neither whip nor snap.
I bet you still can.
Here's a quote from May at the very end. She says, "I feel I'm in class by myself. I only do what comes naturally. I don't want children. I'm too absorbed in myself. To be a star, you have to be a little better than anyone else. I guess I wasn't conscious of being sexy. It was natural. You have to be healthy on the inside or else it shows on the outside. I don't like to be made nervous or angry. My secret is positive thinking and no drinking. I've lived the same way ever since I can remember. Everything I do pertains to myself. I've always been two people. No one can write Mae West dialogue better than Mae West." That gives you a hint of what kind of a person she was.
Yeah. And she really didn't have girlfriends either, right? She just wasn't a chick person.
Marlena Dietrich.
Oh, really? Well, Marlena was pretty, not her competition, you know?
Yeah, they were different, you know. They were entirely different types of stars, and they worked at Paramount together. And there's a scene in the book where Marlena gets a hold of one of the dresses that the designer had made for Mae and tried to put it on. And of course, Marlena was so skinny
and tall.
They had a good laugh together.
That must have been funny. It's sort of like when Ginger, Marianne thinks she's Ginger. And when she falls and hits her head, and she shortens all of Ginger's dresses. Oh. So Mae and Marlena did that first. They must have gotten that from Gilligan's Island. Gilligan's Island got it from them. Anyway, Patrick,
sure
you have been a delight. We have been chatting for almost an hour.
And good heavens.
Yes, where did time go? And I'm going to tell you guys, I love Ray Bourbon. I feel for him, but he was such a character. And, of course, Mae West is Mae West. And I would highly recommend you buy Patrick's book. The name of the book, Patrick, is
Double Entendre, The Parallel Lives of Mae West and Ray Bourbon.
And thank you. Guess what? You're the first guest of my podcast, my first classic movie podcast, my first guest. Thank you
for being here. That's very exciting. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for letting me know, and thank you for hanging in there. Thank you so much. Okay.
And come up and see me sometime.
Ah, well, big boy. Okay. Take care, Patrick. And thank you, everybody. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks. What a fun show. Thank you, everybody. And next week, we're going to have the author of the Barbara Payton book, and you're going to love it. It's going to be fabulous. Thanks, everybody. Patrick was great. Bye.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. the fundamental things apply as time goes by. It's still the same old story of fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome.